Before we begin, let's take a few moments to worship the Supreme One, the Infinitely Compassionate One, the Sublime One, the Tathagata, by chanting the Namaskara 3 times, all together and with me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. You and I, we all consider the Buddhist religion to be more than just a religion. As in, I believe, and so do most of us today, that it's more than just a religion, it's more of a philosophy or a science. It is something that we don't just take by faith. Instead, it's something that we use in our day-to-day life. Just like every single day, we use science. I don't know, to boil a hot cup of water, right, to make tea, we use science. Just like that, we use the Buddhist philosophy for life. Now, the question is, in this science, we have this thing which we call worship. What is worshipping in science, or in the science of Buddhism? What is worshipping? Because it's something that, you know, we do very regularly. For example, before we started the sermon, we worshipped. But what is worshipping? What is true worship? This is the question that I want to answer today. Because I think it's very important for us to actually understand what it is what we do. Because, you know, we're not doing things because out of faith. Although faith is needed for us to start, faith isn't what drives us. As the Buddha himself says, faith or conviction is the greatest relative, jnati. Because you need some sort of faith for us to start. Because if you have no faith in what I'm saying, would you be able to understand anything? No, we have to have some sort of trust, some sort of faith that, okay, what is going to be said will be something along the lines of the truth. However, we're not driven by faith. So the question is, what is worship? What is it to worship? Now, if we looked at what is it that we actually worship, and we come to this, we can group everything together and say, you know, we worship, especially in more Asian continents, we worship our parents. We worship our elders. We worship, for example, the Mahasangha. You know, we bow down in front of religious leaders, a priest. So what is true worship? Is it something that we do just because, or is it something that has a deeper meaning behind it? Because actually worshiping is so much more profound than we think. Because the more you think about it, the more you put in this the Dhamma into our daily lives, the more these small things have great meaning. You know, although it's just maybe, in the morning you just go and worship the Buddha statue, the statue of the Buddha. But behind that, there is so much more of a meaning. So again, let's break it down, right? This word worshipping, if we break it down, you can almost break it down into two parts. Wor, or W-O-R, and ship. Now, let's take a moment to look at this word ship. Right? Think of all the words that has the wordship. Relationship. Kingship. Kingmanship. What else? What else? What other words that has the word ship in it?
Friendship.
There we go. Now, these words, this word ship is always about two people, two or more people. So friendship cannot be a single thing. Now, you can't have a friendship with one, with yourself. You can't have a singular and have a ship. So the word shipping is always about two things, at least two. There has to be two distinct things. And we have the word war. War. Now, that itself has no meaning. Right? W-O-R has no meaning. However, if we add another two letters. Now, this is not me saying that this is how worship came to be. This is how I see worship. So don't think that, you know, this is how, you know, this is where the word came from and whatnot. Because I am not very fluent in Latin, right? But the word worship, for me, feels like this. It's almost as if you can add thy, which makes the word what? Worthy. Now, what does it mean to, why should we add the word worthy in worship? What is this worthy? What is worthy? Who is worthy? See, in a very two-dimensional way, we can say worthy is people who are greater than us. So, mothers, fathers, you know, teachers, grown-ups, elders, grandparents, and we can say anyone who's older than us. In a very 2D sense, we can say that. But when we break it down, you know, we've come to the point where we understand a person is more than just, you know, who they are. A person is not a who, but a construct of what. So to make up a person, we need what? A body and a mind. Now, this idea of body. Can a body be worthy? How can a body be worthy? Now, for a body to be worthy, it means a body has to be better than something else. Okay, let's break body down. Body can be broken down into its fundamentals, right? You know, you can break it into, you know, we learned in science, right? A body is made from organ systems, which are made from what? A bunch of organs. Which are made from what? Bunch of tissues, which is made from a bunch of cells. Cells are made from a bunch of proteins. So which protein is worthy? Which protein is better than another protein? You know, is protein A better than protein B? Because protein A is longer, so it has to be better than protein B? No. So, what part of the body is worthy? What part of a body is worthy? Bodies aren't what is worthy of, isn't what we worship. But yet it is something that it's something that fuels our worship. So for example, you don't worship thin air. You know, normally for a Buddhist, we worship in front of the Buddha statue, which is not the body. Or we worship a person, which is another body. But what in the statue? For example, you know, we worship statues. So is stone, is plaster, you know, is granite worthy? Do you understand what I mean by worthy? Something to be greater than something else. So what part of a statue is worthy? Because, you know, if stone is worthy, we should all be going around worshipping, you know, every stone we meet. You know, you're walking on a path and your foot actually kicks a stone. We should be there worshipping a stone. But no. The stone isn't worthy. So the body isn't what we worship. The body is not what we worship. Although, you know, throughout our lives, that's the only thing that we looked at. The body. That's the only thing. That's the main focus of our worship. A body. Someone or something. See, this is universal. This is not just about the Buddha. This is about any sort of respect. Because worshipping, or the word worship, is almost synonymous with the word respect. Almost. So again, who do we respect? Do we respect a body? Then what is it that we worship? What is it that we respect? Has to be something here. Has to be something there. Something in the mind. There has to be something very special in the mind that is worthy of our worship. Something special in the mind that is worthy of our respect. What is it? So to answer this, we have to actually explore what the mind actually is. So we all know, everyone, every so-called living, in inverted commas, every living being has a mind. Has a way to interpret the external world. You know, we have our six senses, five senses plus the mind itself, which is able to interpret the external world and, you know, give an idea, or give a perception of what the world truly is. That is the purpose of the mind. So if I was to ask, whose mind is worthy? Whose mind is greater than another? It's very difficult to actually pinpoint and say which mind is greater. Because let's say we're seeing these flowers, right? The flowers in front of me. When we are all seeing flowers, the mind arises saying, I see flowers. I can see a red flower here. I can see a red flower. Or the mind says, red flower is perceived. Now that is almost the same between every single mind. Which one is better? Which perception is greater than the other? If you're closer, you're further, if it's a white light, a blue light, which light or which perception is greater? Which perception is worthy? See, we can't answer that. Because for us, or for the idea of a mind arising and passing away, each and every mind is the same. So is it minds that we worship? Is it minds that we worship? It's not mind itself, but it's something within the mind. So for example, you know, people will highly respect people who are incredibly intelligent. So to this day, you know, the science community is highly regards people like Einstein and people like Stephen Hawking, and they're regarded as really intelligent beings. And they're highly respected. Because of their mind? Is it because of their mind? It's more than just the mind. Worship, the word worship, the worthy in worship, isn't talking about the body, isn't talking about proteins, isn't talking about, you know, atoms. Isn't talking about the mind itself, it's talking about something, a part of the mind. It's talking about what? The qualities of the mind. So for a mind to arise, there has to be a mind base or some sort of, you know, environment for the mind to arise. In that environment, there are qualities. And once the mind has arisen, there are qualities. For example, the quality of compassion. The quality of kindness, the quality of selflessness. These are qualities that are part and parcel of the mind. Now, here's the thing, right? It's very easy to come to this conclusion of, you know, it's about qualities. It's about, you know, his quality, her qualities. You know, it's very easy to put qualities and give it a sort of identity. You know, it is, you know, his qualities or her qualities or their qualities. It's very easy to give it an identity. You know, who does that quality belong to? But if you look at it, the quality of kindness belongs to who? Who does kindness belong to? I'm kind, so the quality of kindness belongs to me? Is that how it works? No. Kindness is what? A quality that a mind can possess. For how long? For a single thought. Have you not met a person who, you know, was happy one moment and the next moment is extremely angry? So one moment they are extremely compassionate, thinking about the world. The next moment they are, you know, furious, thinking about how to seek revenge. One mind had compassion, the other mind had what? Anger. So it's a quality that the mind possesses at that single moment. So who owns kindness? Who owns compassion? Who owns friendship? Who owns it? It's not something that someone owns. It's never something that someone owns. Instead, it's something that a mind can possess. It's a quality that a mind can possess. So, you know, you probably have all met people who are, you know, no matter what they do, they always do things with a good intention. No matter what. Whenever they help a person, they do it with incredible good intention. That quality isn't something that is part of them. Instead, it is a part, that quality is something that the mind will possess at that moment. So even this quality of good and bad, you know, what is good and what is bad? You know, we can say, you know, this person is a good person, this person's a bad person. You know, he has good qualities, he has bad qualities. But the thing is, when we talk about people and people being good and people being bad, we're not talking about people here. We're talking about a mind. So for those of you who know, you know, the story of the Buddha, you know, normally when we talk about the story of the Buddha, we always say, you know, Devadatta was the Buddha's, his enemy. You know, he was a very bad person. He was a horrible person trying to, you know, find ways to harm the sasana. But don't forget, those are just minds. Those were just a mind. A mind arose, a mind passed, and that's it. Unfortunately, for every action, you know, karma is collected. You know, this energy for it to come back to you is collected. Apart from that, just a mind. So Devadatta, you know, doing all this, you know, at that moment he's planning, he has what? The mind possesses its bad qualities. But don't forget, Devadatta had what? Had irdi. Had these so-called, you know, this ability to focus, this ability to concentrate. And is that ability something that's easy to get? If so, why don't we have it? No, it's something that he had to practice. Something that's a quality, a good quality that he possesses. Patience. Sometimes we don't have that patience. So is Devadatta the bad or good? No, it's a quality of the mind. So what are we actually worshipping? Qualities. Qualities. So when we worship our so-called, when we worship our parents, what are we actually worshipping? Qualities. Some sort of quality. Now, what is that quality? See, when you're worshipping, and now you know a definition of the word worship. Not the definition, we don't know. But one of the definitions of worship, whether they're worthy. So you know, next time you worship, you should be thinking about what? What quality does that person possess? What quality does that person possess? So when you think about your parents, what quality does your parents possess? Now, for children, it's very easy. You know, they give me food. You know, they clothe me. You know, they when I'm sad, they're there to cheer me up. But don't forget, for every single one of us alive today, has to have what? Has to have what? A mother and a father. They possess a quality that no other person in this world can ever possess. What's that? The quality of giving birth to you. The quality of motherhood. The quality of fatherhood. There is no one else in this world that has the same quality for you. See, at the very least, they've given you life. That's a quality worthy of your worship. That's a very worthy quality, is it not? Because without your life, would you be here today? Without your life, would you be able to do whatever you do today? Help the people that you help. Contemplate on the path. What can you do without that? So at the bare minimum, aren't they worthy? At the bare minimum, right? Imagine they just gave birth and they left, right? And you were, you know, alone against the elements all by yourself. But they still have the quality of giving birth to you. That's something that no other person in this world can do for you. That itself makes it worthy. That itself is why we worship, at the bare minimum, worship our parents. Now, that's the thing. Whoever you respect. So, worthy, respect. I'm using these interchangeably because they're very similar. Except worthy has a bit more of a, you know, almost a more of a religious feel. But no, the word respect is the same. We respect not people. We respect a quality that the person possesses or that mind possesses. If that leader is a very, you know, kind leader, we don't respect the leader for being a leader. We respect him or her because it's kind, because they possess the quality of kind. So worthy respect, same thing. However, with worship, there's a bit more. When we worship, for example, the Buddha, what do we do? What do we do? We bow down. We bow down. What is that? What do you think that signifies? What is that symbolic for? For someone to bow down, what is that trying to say? What's that trying to show? This is beneath. This is beneath. What is this? My ego is what? Beneath. Because if you think about it, not all people can worship. Not all people can worship. People who feel that, you know, I am the greatest person alive, I am amazing, I am this, I am that. People with extremely high egos cannot see this worthiness of others, cannot bow down and worship. Only those who are humble, only those who are modest, only those who understand the true meaning of worship is able to actually worship, is able to actually respect. Think about it. A person with great ego, can they respect another person? Can they respect another person? Very difficult. You know, it's my right that they do this for me. You know, they must do this for me. That's why. That's what they have to do. Not that I respect them for that. So, you know, the actual bowing down in front of, so say for example the Buddha, or for example our parents, signifies this idea of me, I'm putting my ego at your feet. That the quality that you possess is above me. But not only that. Have you, I don't know if you've ever learned in science about siphoning? Siphons? You know, you probably have all seen siphons, right? Somewhere. You know, if you have not seen siphons, you've probably used it for, you probably used it to clean like a fish tank maybe. You know, you have some sort of body of water, and then you have a pipe, right? And for as long as this bit is lower, the water level is lower, what happens? The water will travel along the pipe. You've all seen it, right? It's not just me who's seen siphons, right? Siphoning is one of the most, I think, it's a very, very useful invention, or not invention, useful part of physics, I think, that we use every single day. Now, for a siphon to happen, what needs to be there? Right? What is the number one condition is what? This cup has to be below. This cup has to be below. The moment, you know, the moment you lift this up, what happens? Siphoning comes the other way. Right? The water that you have in your cup will now come into the other one. So, doesn't that look like something to you? Doesn't that look like something to you? When you worship, it's not physically. We're not talking about anything physical here. Although bowing down is physical, let's say your knees are in pain. You're no longer able to bow down. That's okay. Because we're not talking about something physical. We're talking about mentally. The moment you put your mind below, what are you doing? You're creating a siphon. Siphon for what? For their good qualities to be instilled inside of you. For their good qualities to be instilled inside of you. So no matter what their qualities are, the act of worshipping transfers those qualities, or, you know, it transferred the qualities from them to you. Because remember, we're not worshiping people. We're not respecting people. Because we all know a person is something that is 100% able to change. You know, how can you trust a person? It's a good question, isn't it? Because a person is someone that has a mind that is as fickle as anything can be. One mind, one time, you know, at one moment they're very happy and joyish and joyful and whatnot. But the next mind they could be, you know, full on angry and upset. And, you know, we've all seen that. You know, we can't trust a mind. Especially because we can't control minds, can we? No, if we can control our own mind, we can have some sort of trust. But we can't even control our own mind. How can we trust someone else's? That's why we're not worshipping a mind, because we can't trust that mind will be like that forever. We can't trust that mind will be like that forever. Because for as long as it has ignorance and attachment, that mind will always change. Minds are always something that changes. No, you try. Try just focusing on one thing for as long as possible. Right? You know, just think about siphoning. That's it. That's all you can think about. But the moment I say something else, oh, it's changed. The moment we talk about something good and happy, you know, the mind changes to become good and happy. The moment we start talking about something that's really, you know, dark and sad, again, your mind will change. That's how we enjoy. That's why we enjoy watching movies, reading books. Because why? Our mind, our fickle mind will change instantly. When the main character has something good happen to them, we automatically feel what? Good. But when the main character is facing some hardship, we automatically feel what? Sad and bad and angry and whatnot. Because the mind is always, you know, in the mode of changing. For as long as it has ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of how the mind works. It's always going to change. So again, siphoning. What is worship? Worshipping is a siphon. A siphon is siphoning their qualities into you. See, the analogy of siphoning has a small downfall, because for that to be a siphon, you know, this water has to reduce. But in the worship, or in the actual literal sense, nothing reduces the other person. This is why, you know, if you look at it, all the arahants have their ego at where? Where is their ego? For an arahant, where is their ego? For someone who's an anagami, where is their ego? Where is their ego? An anagami who's practicing the path will have their ego as low as they possibly can. Like the great Arahant Sariputta says, Papi Snabhisak. Just like a carpet, I put my ego down. Because once the ego is so low, see, the further you know, we reduce this, the lower this tube is, or the lower this is, the faster the exchange. Long back, we had an experience of this with the tank, you know, the tank that we're building. I think last year or the year before, when we just started, we had a massive flood season. And when it's flooding, the tank was filling up, and it was filling up pretty dangerously fast. So some of our monks and Anagarikas had to decide, you know, either we're going to have to break a section of the wall off, which will be catastrophic, or we're going to have to find a way to siphon the water out. And so that's what they did. They took some pipes, and they siphoned it. A massive, and for those of you who've been near the tank, right, you know how big that is, and very wide. But with that one siphon, which was pretty long as well, you know, every minute you could see the water level slowly reduce. And you know, it was very funny, because at one moment, one of the joints of the pipe was loosening. And so we had the idea of, you know, to stop a siphon, very easy. What you have to do is block this area and the siphon will stop. And so that's what we did, right? And so these Anagarikas, they went inside and they tried to block it. They couldn't come close to the mouth of the pipe. Why is that? Because this pipe was siphoning the water. And bigger the pipe, the longer the pipe, the more force and the more water they can siphon out. But eventually they took, one of the Anagarikas was very smart. They took one of the banana trunk? I don't know what the actual name for it is. So the trunk of a banana tree, and used it to block that. But what amazed us was that the moment we blocked it, all of the pipes instantly just became flat. Why is that? Because this was as low as it could possibly be. It was very low. Now, this is exactly what happens once you put your ego down to the floor. Stopping the qualities of the great Arahants and the Buddha and all these great people coming into you, it becomes what? Unstoppable. See, ego is something. Ego is the biggest hindrance to everything. To everything. Ego is the biggest hindrance to everything. Whether you want to learn, can you learn with a big ego? If you ever think you know more than teacher, can you ever learn? No, to be the best student, where should your ego be? Far beneath. Teacher, I don't know anything. Help me here. To learn anything, to even, you know, to put in the practice of the path. Again, for your teachers, where should your ego be? At the very, as low as you can possibly take it. Because the lower it is, the harder for this to stop. And the faster it is that the water or the great qualities are pumped into yours. You see, there was no motors involved, nothing's involved. It's a natural process. So naturally, this is what we have to do. Worship. Worship in the sense of putting our ego as down as we possibly can. But there's two ways. Either put our ego as low as we possibly can, or else, how else can we increase the amount of water flow? Take this and push it as high as we possibly can. We have to do both. With the Dhamma, we're able to get this as low as we possibly can. We get to lower this to the very bottom. But also, don't forget, you have to see the qualities. We have to know what is being pumped in. The more that we know, what happens? The further this goes up. This is why, you know, don't take the act of respecting or the act of worshipping to be very light. You know, actually think about it. When you worship, think about it. Why am I actually worshipping this? Why am I worshipping? Why am I worshipping? Why am I worshipping, you know, him or her? Am I worshipping him or her? That's why, you know, it's very, very nice to see that, you know, sometimes, so for example, when we meet Guru Handru, right, our teacher, sometimes once he's come talk to us, you know, we go worship him. But when we worship him, he's gone. He's already gone. And sometimes, you know, it's very frustrating. You know, you're trying to worship him and he's disappeared, right? But why? Why is it frustrating? Because why? Well, who are we worshiping? Him? See, this is why, you know, we have to be very aware. Just keep it in mind. What is worshiping? Why am I worshiping? What is the purpose of my worship? Because if you do it out of blind faith, none of this happens. If you do this out of blind faith, none of this happens. The only thing that happens is that you just receive a minuscule amount of merits. Minuscule amount of merits because you know what you're doing is a good thing. That's why, you know, sometimes, you know, parents will force their child to go and worship. And, you know, the child will start crying. You're like, no, I don't want to do this. And they're like, no, you have to. Right? What does the child receive? Blessings, of course. But merit-wise, nothing. I mean, the blessing is there. I mean, no matter whether the child worships or not, the blessing is anyway there. So we have to really be aware. Keep that in mind, you know. Think about this. I'm worshipping for what? I'm worshipping the qualities that they have. I'm worshipping the qualities. This is why, you know, when you worship the Buddha, put your ego as low as you possibly can. When you're worshipping anyone, put your ego as low as you possibly can. That's why, teachers in the past will always say, don't worship the biggest monk. Worship the youngest, the smallest. See if your ego lets you do that. Something that Guru Handru always say is like, you know, sometimes seeing people worship is like seeing evolution happen. How? Because for the, you know, the Nayaka, the big monks, you know, the person would worship at their feet. And as they go along the path, their back will start to straighten. And the last person, they'll just be like, you know, and that. For the very last person, it'll be bye, and they leave. But really, what should it be? If you're truly worshiping every single one of them, whether they're the youngest, or like, you know, just into the sasana, or no, not even in, you know, just entered the just entered the sasana, doesn't mean being a monk or being a monk, or even an anagarika or anagarika. You should see them exactly the same. Treat them exactly the same. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, you should go around worshipping every single person you meet. No. But in your head, this should be something that should be running all the time. In your head, this is what should be running every single moment. What am I doing? This mind has a quality. That's why, you know, Sariputta Maharatana would say, you know, anyone who seeks refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, may they be on the top of my head. Anyone who seeks refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Now this could be, you know, someone saying they could be a horrible person, but if they seek refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, which means they are willing to change themselves, I'll keep them on the top of my head. That's why, you know, Guru Ananda would say, you know, if you require, if say for example, let's say you need help traveling from A to B. If you're someone who is willing or who has taken refuge with the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, he is willing to come and help you travel from A to B. Because remember, we are all here doing the same thing. We are all here doing the same thing, looking for our liberation. Liberating ourselves from pretty much our own suffering. Every single person in this world is doing that. Whether, you know, you are the richest man or woman alive, whether, you know, you're a monk or an anagarika, you're doing the same thing. You're trying to find the next way to liberate yourself. How can I stop myself from being sad? One person says, you know, earn as much money as possible, right, so I can relieve it as quick as possible. And the other says, you know, actually, let's not think about relieving. Instead, let's think about why do I feel this need to relieve? Both doing the same thing, both getting rid of their suffering, but in two different paths. That's why, you know, this is why what I love the most about our monastery. No matter who comes through that gate, everyone is treated the same. No matter who. No one asks for your past and say, oh, have you done this in the past? No, you can't come in. No, whoever enters these two gates, whether, you know, for example, our rehab center. My noble friends, the name itself shows what it truly is. It's a noble friend, a friend, an association that to help that person get out of their problem. So they may have been, you know, one of the most terrible, the worst people in this world. But if they seek refuge, you know, thinking that, you know, I want to change myself. I want to become a better person. I want to take the next step in helping myself understand why am I in this mess. The doors are open. There is no, if you ever have a chance, sometimes when you talk to some of our monks, they'll tell you of their past. And let me tell you, knowing some of our monks, their past hasn't all been, you know, rainbow and sunshine. You know, but yet, they have changed their lives in the most incredible way. I remember one of our monks, mothers came to me and said, you know, thank goodness he's at the monastery. Because if he was at home at this time, right, today, if he was home today, he would have had a life sentence. But now, he wouldn't hurt a soul, hurt a fly, nothing. So you see, this is the thing. The dumb, like, this is why we worship. Because remember, we're not worshiping who. We're not worshiping who. Because who is not in this equation? Who has never been in the equation? Who has never been in any equation? It's just that we believe it's an equation. Because of our own insanity, we believe it's who. We put who in everything. This quality belongs to them. This quality will belong to all these people. We always put who in whatever we possibly can. For example, before we understood about the sun and the moon, we used to think that, people will pull on the sun so it rises every day. They believe that, Apollo would drag his sun carrier from east to west, right, making the sun rise and set. Again, who does that? Apollo does. See, we're always trying to look for who. But once, so who, it's always who. And then, when we understood how it actually works, the world rotates around its axes. That's why the sun rises and falls. Now we say, okay, now it's just a process, natural process. People used to believe that, when it's thundering and lightning, why was it thunder and lightning? It's because someone was angry. Zeus was angry, throwing his lightning bolts across the sky. Why again? Because they wanted to know who, or they wanted to give it to a who. I mean, if you think about it, if it's a who, it's very easy, right? Who? Zeus. So what should we do? We will sacrifice something to make Zeus happy. Therefore, there will not be any storms. Very easy. But when you realize it's a process, you realize, oh, there's nothing I can do except try to change the conditions. When we learn that lightning happens because of positive or negative charges, what we do is we shove an iron rod into the sky, and hopefully, the iron rod will dissipate the electric charges. Very simple. But before, every single day, there would have been sacrifices. Learning about history of the world, I think more than we sacrifice animals, we've sacrificed humans. Daily, monthly, yearly. In order to satisfy someone, not realizing it's a process. We personify the natural case of death. Who controls death? Who controls death? The guy with the scythe? The Grim Reaper? The Grim Reaper controls death. He comes knocking on your door and, you have no choice but to follow him. See, even the natural process of death is given who? Given a who. Why? Because we want, because our ignorance, our own insanity has given that. Always a who. I think back in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, there used to be gods of doors, god of doorways, god of bottles, god of everything, because they wanted a who. Always a who. If you even look even further back, like in Norse tradition, they used to think that everything has a who inside of them. So they give everything, from everything they make, right? Whether there's a chair or a table, a sword or a necklace, they would give it a specific name because they thought everything had a who. We always want to find who. Why? Because then we can say who's responsible. We can give the sense of responsibility to someone else. So we can be, we can be free. But what we have to do is take that out of it and see it for what it truly is. See the world as it truly is. That's what we have to do. See the world as it truly is. Because if we don't see it, we live in this feeling of insanity where who is the most important question. Where who is the most important question, rather than how can I stop it or how can I start it? It's who does it, who starts it, who stops it. So this is why worship. And then you have to see who is worthy. Really? Do you see who is worthy? Are you focused? Who is worthy? No, no, no. What is worthy? What quality is worthy? So again, keep that in mind. Keep that in mind while you do everything in life. Keep it in mind. So again, worthy, synonymous with respect. So even if you respect someone, right? Understand why you respect them. That it's not they and them that you respect. Because if you were to respect a person and they do something bad, this is very common, right? You know, you think of a person to be so good, so holy, right? And they do one thing wrong. That tarnishes your image of them. That tarnishes your image of them. And therefore, you could never see them the same way again. You can never respect them the same way again, even though maybe you have no choice. You may not have any choice, but, you know, it tarnishes it. And you think, oh no, this person is like this now. This person is always like this now. But no, this is we're respecting or we're worshipping qualities. Now, so another topic that I really wanted to go through with all of you is this idea of value as well. Because value is something that no matter how much we talk about, it's something that's instilled within us. What is it, what value something has? Now, I was talking the other day with a certain individual, and they were telling me how they were expecting, you know, that they bought something that's really, really expensive. Right? And they bought something that's really expensive, and after they bought it, they felt really guilty. I shouldn't have bought that, you know, it was too expensive. I could have bought it for cheap and whatnot. But this idea of value is something that is deeply ingrained in each and every one of us. That's why if I was to show you two things, automatically you can give one thing more value than the other. It's almost ingrained within us. Oh, this is, you know, just foam and whatnot. This is porcelain. This is very expensive. Or whatnot, you automatically have that instilled within you. But the idea, it's not just knowledge. The feeling of value is not just knowledge. Your feeling of value is beyond just knowledge. It grasps at this idea of this is the value that this holds. This is the value that this holds. So if we were to explore this, a t-shirt. What is the value of a t-shirt? Now it depends. Depends on what? It's actually very dependent. Whether you like it or not, it's very dependent on what is over here. No? Depending on what is over in this area. Let's just change to a different color. Depending on what's in this area will change the value of that t-shirt. Very simply, depending on the brand, right? Living in the 21st century, we have thousands of brands and very, very expensive high-end brands as well, right? For the purpose of this discussion, we will not be using any, hopefully you're not going to be using any names. Can't see, we'll see about that. And not only that, the idea of limitedness. What do I mean? If there's only 12 of these t-shirts around, this t-shirt is what? Very expensive, very valuable, just 12 of them in the entire world, no more than 12. If, you know, we decided that we're not going to have 12, just two. There's only two of these in the world. Now what? This is one of the most expensive, the most valuable t-shirts ever. Now, how does this number actually affect? How does this number actually affect the t-shirt? Whether there's five of them made, tens of them made, millions of them made, how does that affect the t-shirt? It doesn't. It affects what we feel. It affects how we feel or we perceive this value. We say that, oh, there's only two of these in this world. Therefore, it has to be rare. It has to be very valuable. So I can reduce the value by just removing this. By removing how many there are, I've already reduced the value. If I was to reduce this, the brand, again, the value of the t-shirt drops. When it comes to, or let's say, then I can say, you know, this isn't new, this is secondhand. Again, the value now drops further. But there's always going to be a minimum, right? For example, you know, if you looked at the material and the labor and all the stuff, say, you know, there will always be a minimum cost of a t-shirt, right? However, looking back at it, even the manufacturing costs still add up to zero. Let me explain. All right. To make the t-shirt, if we go back in time, right, it belonged in a factory, right? A factory where, you know, again, my drawing skills are not too good. I will try my very best to draw what I think. A sewing machine looks like. And before it was sewn, right, we had say it's made out of cotton, right? So we have a cotton plant. Now each of these steps of the manufacturing process has to give it value, right? Each, because, you know, this has a sort of value. This, you know, the actual sewing and cutting. I'm not going to try to draw scissors. The sewing and cutting part of it also has value, and the actual product has value, right? There's nothing we can do, right? Just like we erase number two to reduce the value. However, if we looked at sewing, what is sewing? What is the actual process of sewing? So for those of you who have ever been near a sewing machine, knows that it is, you know, a needle going through a piece of cloth, you know, and, you know, actually, if you look at a sewing machine is a marvel. You know, the way a sewing machine works is amazing. But if you looked at it broken down, all it's doing, it's just poking through a cloth. Turning electrical energy into kinetic energy. Just turning electrical energy into kinetic energy. That's all the sewing machine does. Just changes electrical energy, because it's always plugged into some sort of power supply, right? But just changing electrical energy into kinetic energy. What is the value of kinetic energy? What is its arbitrary value? Is it how much does it cost per joule? How much does kinetic energy cost per joule? Can we say that? But don't forget, you know, for there to be a sewing machine to work, you know, there has to be a sweatshop where people are working, you know, day in, day out. What is a person? What is a person? A person is a machine that changes chemical energy into kinetic energy. At our basic fundamental, what do we do? You know, using this equation of, you know, glucose plus oxygen equals carbon dioxide plus water, da 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 da, we take chemical energy, we turn it into what? Kinetic energy. Again, what is the value of kinetic energy? What is the value of chemical energy? So for this cloth to be cut out and made, each time it's using just energy, what is the value of just energy? What is the value of energy? How much, you know, cents per joule? If that is so, every time the wind blows, what's being expended? Money. We have to stop the wind. We're wasting money. You know, we have to stop the sun because we're wasting what? Money. We have to stop kinetic energy completely because why? You have to pay for it. What is the value of kinetic energy? It doesn't have a value. It can't be given a value. It's not something that you can say, oh, for every joule, it's 0.0001 cents. You can't say that. It doesn't have a value. Okay. The cotton plant. What is the worth of a cotton plant? How much is it worth? Now, society will give a value for this, as well as society will give another value for this. But if you look at its fundamental, what is a cotton plant? What is a cotton plant? Excuse me. What is a cotton plant? A cotton plant, in its basic fundamentals, using what? Sun, water, nutrients. To make what? Some sort of fiber, which we call what? Cotton. So what is cotton? Cotton is solar energy, right? Or technically it's just using, you know, photons and heat energy, as well as water, as well as nutrients to make what? Cotton. So cotton is, the value of cotton should be the same as what? The value of the sun. How much value is the sun? What is the value of the sun? How much do we pay per hour for the sun to keep going? How much do we pay? Zero. How much do we pay for water to fall out of the sky? Per hour? No, we don't pay. Well, technically. Technically, these days we're paying per hour, I think, sometimes. Sometimes paying for minutes. Sometimes it's paying for seconds of an annoying drizzle. But how much are we paying for the rain? For the water? We're not paying for that. The nutrients in the soil. What is its value? Not to forget this, the nutrients coming that came through the nutrient that came from the soil is from, you know, it's from its own cycle. We don't do anything for that. It's something that comes naturally. So the actual value of a cotton plant is what? Priceless. And priceless meaning doesn't have a value. Priceless, less of no price. And then you have, you know, these harvesting machines, you know, the way, you know, they've got these massive, you call them combine harvesters to get rid of, to take all this cotton. What is that doing? Using, you know, some sort of fuel and turning into kinetic energy. Again, just a transfer of energy to get this into a form where it's able to be sown. Or sown, in another word, to be changed physically using energy. To be sold as the result of all of energy's work. So what is the value of the t-shirt? Sun, water, nutrients. Chemical, kinetic. Electrical, kinetic. Chemical, kinetic. Because remember, this cotton plant is doing absolutely nothing but what? Taking all this and just growing. It's doing nothing but that. It's using just energy and storing it. Storing energy as what we call cotton. As a fiber, which we call cotton. And then we cut it, we sew it, we put it all together, we get a t-shirt. Which is just what? What is a t-shirt fundamentally? Energy. 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 Comes from energy. Energy, 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 energy. This is what? The effect of what? All of these energies coming together. So how much does energy cost? What is the value of energy? What is the value of energy? A solid zero. But then you could say this. However, you know, at this very moment, a cotton plant costs X. Labor costs Y. The actual stuff costs Z. Right? The t-shirt itself costs A. The brand costs B. The shop costs C. The profit costs D. And let's say, you know, you get this signed by someone, right? Right? That costs E. And now this t-shirt costs E. Which comes from something that costs nothing to something that costs approximately, let's see if you got rid of the signature, right? A good t-shirt would cost, I don't know, how much, like, how much? You tell me. How much does a good t-shirt cost? I know that you can get t-shirts for, like, over 70... Yeah, I think over 70 pounds, but I don't know about rupees. How much does a good a t-shirt that has a good logo cost? 10,000? Huh? 1,000? But for a good one. So, what is the actual value of the t-shirt? Zero. But its overall end value that you feel it to be? ₹1 lakh? Very expensive. Extremely expensive. So, this is the thing, I mean, now, this doesn't mean, right, I'm not against, you know, buying and selling and whatnot. None of this. But it's this idea that, you know, this value belongs to this. No, what you have to realize is the value of this is this, is a full solid zero. The value of this is zero. But because of society and, you know, all this, that we have placed above it, on top of it, this. But the actual value is what? Zero. The actual value is zero. Nothing else. Because if you fall into the trap that saying that, you know, actually this costs this much. Now this becomes something that you feel that is an object that can cause you a lot of suffering. Imagine a teacher that costs 100,000. How would you wear it? Would you wear it? No, you'd prize it on a wall and say, I'm not going to take that off. But really, what is it? What is its actual value? Zero. Okay, compare the t-shirt with this eraser. This whiteboard eraser. Which one's more valuable? Which one's more valuable? This is what? Zero. This is also what? T-shirt plus building. Which one's more valuable? T-shirt or building? Building, of course, is a building. You know, there has to be all this cement, all this water, all this bricks, you know, the putty, and then you have to paint it, and then you have to build it. Don't forget the roof and all of this stuff that costs in real life, in actual real life. How much does it cost? Zero, but we feel it costs, you know, 2 million, 3 million. Where does that come from? Again, what we have to remember, like all we have to do is just understand that the actual value of something is zero. Because then you don't find that, you know, if something was to happen to this, you don't feel affected. You paid 1 lakh for this t-shirt, right? You know, your child comes up and spills a cup of their blueberry drink on your t-shirt. Now, if you were to feel what? That this is a 100,000 rupees t-shirt, now you're horrified. But when you realize that, you know, it costs zero, you'll be thinking, okay, can I wash this off? Oh, I can wash it off, but, you know, it's the stain is still there. The stain is still there. You know, I can wear this in this occasion, that occasion. That's not such a big of a deal. Now, the child will be scolded nonetheless, right? So they don't do it again. But you're not scolding them because they ruined this. You're scolding them because they've made a mistake and you're encouraging them not to do it again. Not to run with the cup of blueberry juice in their hands. The house, you know, they say the building that you're in, you know, there's a crack on the wall. Now, if you thought that, you know, I had to pay this much amount of money for this, like, why is there a crack on the wall? If you feel that this building has a value, now what? Now you're thinking about how I can protect it, how I can, you know, when it breaks, you're now going to be upset. But if you realize it doesn't have value, now you think, okay, can I fix this? Yes, okay, I'll try. If not, there's nothing I can do. See, by removing value, you're removing this, or by not removing value, you can't remove the amount here, but you can remove the amount in your mind. I mean, this is very controversial when you come to talk about, you know, things that are living and things that are not living. For example, if I was to take a bunny, right, a bunny and this eraser, which one's more valuable? You know, from the very from the very deep corners of our heart, we think what? The bunny has life. This doesn't have life. Life has to be an aspect of this. You know, life has to have some sort of extra value. Again, in a very, if you looked at the reality, the fundamental reality, both of these have the same value. Because why? They're both made from the same things. You know, you can take all the carbon atoms from the bunny and take all the carbon atoms from this. Which one is different? I could take, you know, the oxygen from this and the oxygen from the bunny, and they are both exactly the same. The only difference that between the bunny and this is that the bunny has a mind, but mind is also what? Energy. The value of a mind energy is zero. Now, this doesn't mean you go around on a kidding frenzy, right? hurting and killing other beings, because that's not right. And that doesn't mean you have to, you know, that doesn't mean you don't care about this. No, you care about everything that you use, because, you know, even though it doesn't have value, it's still something. You know, just because your body doesn't have value doesn't mean you shouldn't keep it clean. Just because, you know, your car doesn't have any value doesn't mean you can just, you know, dump everything inside. No, you have to keep it clean, keep it tidy, you have to upkeep it. For every single thing that you own, you have to maintain it. For every single thing that you own, you have to maintain it. This is why, you know, that is what weighs everyone down. You know, we believe the more we have, the more the happier I'll be. You know, if I have a big house with many rooms, with many things, I'm going to be extremely happy. I'm going to be so, so, so happy. But if they fail to understand that, you know, if I have a big house, there's a lot more I have to look after. There's a lot more that I have to think about. Now, you know, if you lived in just a one-bedroom house, you only have to look after that one bedroom, a toilet, and a kitchen. But if you own a mansion, now what? 12 bedrooms, 19 bathrooms, one swimming pool, and now every single thing you have to look after. Either you have to look after it, or else someone else is going to have to. Either way, you are putting more burden on yourself, thinking that more the merrier. No, the more you have, the more you have to look after, the more weight it puts onto yourself. Think about this, right? Someone who is homeless, do they wake up in the middle of the night thinking about their keys? Did I lock the front door? Did I close all the windows? Did I lock my safe? Is my safe safe? Is my safe safe? Honestly, someone who is homeless can sleep. Physically, you know, the heat, the cold, I understand. Physically, they have their difficulties. But mentally, they only have their prized possessions with them right there. And all they have to do is put them all in one place and fall asleep. You know, if someone was to come, if you get the letter of, what do you call it? You know, if you get the letter that you have to be removed from a house, right, you know, your tenant has said that, you know, you can no longer stay here, we have another person who wants to come here, and you have to move from a house. Now, how much things do you have to use to, you know, you have to have a moving van, hundreds of friends, just to move your stuff from one place to the other. Now what? If the homeless person had to move, pick up a small bag and move. Put it down, sleep wherever. Again, physically, there'll be issues. But mentally, they're not. See, the more the merrier is when it comes to people, that could be. When it comes to things, not so much. The more you have, the more weight it is on yourself. And the more it's pushing down and weighing you down. And, you know, sometimes, if you were to go into the mindset of someone who owns, let's say the richest man or woman alive, just go into the mindset of them, where you have absolutely everything you desire. Right, every moment you breathe, you get hundreds of thousands of dollars. However, you know, think about this, right? If you're the richest man or woman alive, everywhere you go, who do you have to bring with you? If this is you, on your four corners, you have to have Satramandayu. the four guardian deities, right? Have to have bodyguards. Because I am the happiest person alive? No, I'm the most scared person alive. Will there be someone today who's going to hurt me? Is there someone going to hurt me today? Will someone... I mean, if you think about it, if you get a phone call, aren't you scared as well? Just a phone call. Will this phone call be a good phone call or a bad phone call? See, you get a phone call from one of your companies. How do you pick it up? You pick it up not knowing. Will they say, oh, you know, sir or madam, we've just received this and, you know, we're going to, you know, your sales are going to boost because of this. Or will they get the phone call saying, unfortunately, one of your servers in the middle of the Bahamas have now just set alight. We're losing money ASAP. What should we do? They pick up the phone not knowing. Now, if they have one company, there's only one thing to worry about. But if you have millions of companies, now every phone call is a phone call that gives them, every time they look at their phone, their heart will skip a beat. Will this be a good one or a bad one? I mean, yeah, you say that the more we have, the happier you'll be. If you're a materialist in thinking that, you know, the more I have, the better my life will be. Not really. No, this is not saying having things is bad. I mean, how great is it that we have a vehicle, a car? You know, if we didn't have a car, we'd have to be walking from place A to B, if we had to go from, say, you had a doctor's appointment, you had to travel, you have to start leaving 2 days earlier just so you make there, you get there on time. I mean, we're lucky to have things. But the question is, how much of something do we need? I mean, we're very lucky to be in an era where we have, you know, major developments in technology. I mean, you know, every single year, the phone in your pockets will change, will become better and better. You know, nowadays, someone told me that, you know, some phone cameras are better than big movie cameras. Now, we have all this. It's all good. But to what extent do we need? To how much of this do we need? Because the more we have, the more burden we have on our shoulders. Like, a phone is something that helps us. But a phone is also something that can destroy us. A phone is something that can help. A phone is also something that you can destroy. So this is the thing, we have to be really aware of what we use. So think about this, like, what is the value of things around us? What is your self-value? What is your self-value? What value do you have for yourself? How much? Are you extremely valuable? What part of you is extremely valuable? What body part? What protein? What cell? What neuron is the most valuable one? That's the thing. By understanding this, where does your cup go? Where does your cup go? The siphon cup goes lower and lower and lower. And other people? Other qualities? Go higher and higher and higher. See, you see how beautiful this is. The more you understand, the more your ego is able to reduce. That's why, you know, that's why this journey of understanding, or the journey of learning itself, is something that's exponential. Like, if you go back to the days that you had to learn maths, how difficult it was to wrap your head around 1 + 1. But now you're able to understand not just 1 + 1, but, you know, differentiation, integration, and all these weird and wonderful things, because you learned, you know, 1 + 1, and it was very difficult. Same thing with this. The more you understand this, the lower your ego goes. The lower your ego goes, the faster it becomes. That's why it's easier for someone who's anagami to attain an arahant, because their ego is so low. Their ego is low. But if they increase their ego and says, "Oh, I am anagami," then they are anagami. Then they're not practicing the path. They're not practicing what they're supposed to. They're not practicing this. So are they on the path? You know, all we have to do is understand this. You know, the Buddha comes to this world to preach anicca dukkha anatta. I mean, we are all here for that and that alone. You know, sometimes we forget about this. We forget about what the purpose of all this is. You know, I think in our monastery, one of the most dangerous parts is that we are very, you know, we are always thinking about how we can help another person. Sometimes what we don't realize is our mindset changes from, you know, attaining nibbana to helping. Just helping. Instead of targeting attaining nibbana, now it's just, how can I help? Nibbana put to the side, how can I help? But remember, these two go hand in hand. If you can't find the balance, you're going in the wrong track. If you can't find the balance, you're going on the wrong track. It's always nibbana and how can I help another? Your nibbana and their nibbana. If you're not in the balance in the middle of that, you're going the wrong way. If you're totally focused on your nibbana, then you are traveling on a journey to attain nibbana for you. Yeah. Trying to make jati attain nibbana. Trying to help a ghost to attain nibbana, impossible. But if you target, you know, others, now you are, you know, shooting in the dark. You know, without helping yourself, you're trying to help another person, like a drowning man trying to help a drowning man. Both of you will drown faster. Actually, maybe the other person may be able to come up, but you will continue to drown. No, it's a balance between my nibbana and their nibbana. You have to find the exact balance. Once you found the balance, you know that you're going on the right track. Know that you are actually pushing on and following the track, and both will happen. My nibbana and their nibbana. Whoever they are, it doesn't matter. This is why we worship who? The Lord Buddha. Because without the Lord Buddha, would we ever have understood any of this? Because what is this actually talking about? This is talking about the anatta nature of the world, the anicca nature of the world, the dukkha nature of the world. We are looking at the anicca, dukkha, anatta nature of the entire world. And that was, no matter how simple this seems, we can't understand this by ourselves. It's thanks to the Buddha. The Buddha was able to, you know, with his incredible wisdom, to see the world for what it is, to be able to break down everything into its fundamentals and see the world as it is, as a mind and a body. He understood the body. Body, again, doesn't mean body as in this body. Body as in everything, physically. And he's able to understand mind. He understood the mind like no other. Understanding why do we feel that this costs this much when it's actually this? And he was able to show us that, you know, it's because of ignorance. This is why the Buddha is worthy of our worship. That's why the Buddha is incredibly worthy. And this is why, you know, this is why we worship the Buddha. You know, every time we do a Buddha Puja, what do we say? We say, Itipiso, Bhagava, Arahant, Sammā, Sambuddho, and we say 9 of his qualities. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, these 9 qualities, you know, sometimes, you know, if you look and if you look at each of these qualities, they have such a great meaning behind them. Because those 9, those each and every one of those 9 qualities holds infinite. So it's also taking an infinite number of qualities and put them into 9 sections. 9 sections which holds what? Infinite. Infinity. So every time you do a Buddha Puja, see this. I mean, put this into your lives. Right? Don't let, like I said, I think we talked about this last week, don't let a moment go by. Don't let a moment go by where you're not practicing, where you're not thinking. See, every single breath you take, you should be practicing. Putting what you understand into practice. Trying to understand yourself trying to understand your mind and the things around you. Try and look at the anicca dukkha, not the nature of the world. Don't let a moment go by. Because this is the time for us to contemplate. Now that doesn't mean you have to, you know, be cornered by yourself, you know, in a corner in the Valley Malua or doing this, just sitting down, right hand, your left hand, breathing. Like, this is not contemplation. You should be able to contemplate everywhere you go. Do you know where the best place to contemplate is? The best place to contemplate. Honestly, I think not just myself, but after having conversations with several others, right? The best place to, the place that contemplation is, you know, the actual contemplation, that's not the Valley Model, right? The Valley Model is, of course, one of the most best places to contemplate. But, you know, in actual day-to-day life, a place where it's really easy to contemplate is when you're by yourself in the toilet. Because at that moment, you have nothing else to do but sit there. And you can contemplate. What am I doing? What is this process that's happening? What is my input in this? When you've sat on the toilet, don't let that moment go either. Take that moment. Trust me when I say this. Sometimes that is where the best contemplation can happen. And just like, you know, Isaac Newton had an apple fall on his head, and that gave him gravity. I didn't give him gravity, but that helped him think about gravity. Let every moment push you forwards. Don't let a single moment go by. Brushing your teeth, another great one. Something that you have to do. But see, what am I doing? How is this happening? What am I doing for this? Because no matter what, hopefully, we all spend, you know, some time brushing our teeth every day. Instead of just brushing and thinking about something completely different, just you brush your teeth and think about this. What is actually happening? Am I brushing my teeth? Or is this a process that is happening? See, sometimes, even like, I remember, like, Guru Har once said that some monk had given him a question, asked him a question, and he didn't answer it there and then, because he didn't know the answer. But that night, before, when he was brushing his teeth, did he understand, or did he find the answer to the question? And the next day, he came to the monk and said, I understood this while brushing my teeth. So don't let a single moment go by. Because this is your life we're talking about. This is the truth we're talking about. So, whatever you understand, put into practice. And Nibbana will happen. So I think this Tuesday we have Dakkhineya. boson. And I think some of our online online sermons from like Siumaga and other sermon groups, they have a see. This is the thing, you know, our monastery wants to give everyone a chance to do merits. So some of our children from Siumaga had drawn pictures for Poson. And it's very nice because I got to see that. So the organizer showed me some of these pictures. And in one of these sermons, there is, I think, a family of Vietnamese. And they had no idea what Jataka was. So they went around and they had done a full research, and even they drew something. And it was, you know. What we have to remember is every time they draw, they are remembering what? Because what does a Jataka hold? What does these stories of the Bodhisattva hold? Amazing qualities. So as they're telling me how, like, every moment they draw, what runs in their heads? A worship of what? Story. You know, the Nallapana Jataka and this Jataka, that Jataka. Every time they draw, in their heads it runs the story. Not just the story, but the qualities of the Bodhisattva. And every time they're drawing, they're worshipping. Putting their cup lower and lower and lower. Slowly and very in a very capillary-like tube, they are slowly taking these qualities in. That's why, you know, our monks think about absolutely everything. How to help anyone. So I think some of our monks have come together, as well as some of our Anagarikas. And I was told that, you know, one of them, who is, I think, just 16 or 17, is preparing, you know, a 3D world. And I have no idea what he's planning to do, but trying to put this all together to make an amazing, you know, they wanted to make a pendulum, right? But they're from all over the world. So what they do is they put them all together and they make a display for us to see. I think we'll be able to see it on Poson Day as well. But I do want to tell you all that so you can all rejoice, as well as, you know, to show you how far we think. Not just monks or anagarikas, but everyone in the monastery thinks, how can we help anyone? But these children, some of these children are, you know, barely 5 years old. But they still took time to draw a Jataka. So again, on Tuesday, we do have Poson. So we had Dakine that day. So please rejoin that. Okay. So now every time you respect someone or worship someone, you have something to think about. I mean, I think that's one of the best things about this. Practical stuff. I mean, theory is all good. I mean, don't think me wrong, but, you know, I like theory as well. But it's the practical that gives it the true oomph. Because now every time you worship, maybe, you know, that comes to your head, the meaning of worshiping. And now I've ruined your worshiping. Now you can no longer just worship someone. Now you're thinking about, what qualities am I worshiping here? I mean, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And that's what's supposed to happen. I mean, you know, I don't think any of you can now eat chocolate. You know, chocolate is something that you can't eat without thinking about it. Cake, you know, we talk about cake all the time. Now when you buy a t-shirt, something you can think about. I mean, we ruin lives, unfortunately. We ruin happiness, don't we? We show the truth, right? And the truth will set you free. From your own suffering. Just my understanding. All right, let's transfer our merits and quickly conclude to this session. Let's take a moment to transfer the merits we've acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, chanting Pirith, this is in the Dharma, and engaging in various meritorious deeds today. So first and foremost, let's remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of Buddha's teachings. And with immense gratitude, let's transfer the message to the Bhikshu Bhikshunis, Upasakas, Upasakas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teaching of the Buddha, and passed it down through the generation of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, to understand, to comprehend Dhamma. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to all the members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including all three pillars of the chapters, who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and committed themselves to the betterment of all sentient beings. Let's not forget, among them will be the monks and nuns visiting local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to Guru Sanansi, as well as the monks resident at the monastery, as well as Anagarikas, Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let's take a moment to transfer merits and express our gratitude to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teaching of the Buddha, be that by translating sermons, sharing them out with others, inviting others to join them. May the path of merits, if any have been born in the world of planes, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blessed plane. May by the power of the merits, may they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble footpath, and attain supreme bliss of Nirvana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's also take one transfer merits required to our devotees, friends of the monastery, who for sake of merits continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes every one of you who have contributed to the construction of the monastery, to those of you who provide Mahasangha with shelter, alms, words, medicines, as well as those who pass on the know-how and their well wishes. May the power of the merits, may they abstain from the meritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble footpath, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. This also takes one chance of merits to our mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews, and nieces, friends and acquaintances, employees, and to all those who have helped us, supported us, assisted us in any shape or form. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical mental ailments, may they overcome any obstacles in spiritual progress, may they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sticking my own transfer merit to the Devas, Brahmas, spirits, demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as numerous gods and deities, who have committed to protect and fulfill the Sambhu Sasana. Let us not forget among them to transfer merits to our garden deities, who keep watch for eye of us, keep us out of harm's way. May the power of the merits, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So also take a moment to transfer merits to our ancestors who have predeceased us, to all that has been friends and family to us in the infinite long journey in samsara. So also take a moment to transfer merits to all the members of the armed forces, as well as the police force, who have sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. May all those lost lives in the war be the friend of foe. Rejoice in the merits required today. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to all those who have lost their lives in their calamities such as tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides, pandemics. Reminding ourselves among them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this long journey in samsara. May the power of the merits, if any of them be born in the world plane, may they redeem themselves and be born in the bliss plane. May by the power of the merits, may they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble footpath, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, it's all resolved. May the power and blessing of all the merits acquired throughout the day, we have been witness the event of many hundreds of thousands of Arhat nuances, Arhat main nuances in this blessed land. And finally, may the power of all the merits acquired throughout the day, you and I and everyone who made this program a success, become an Arhat nuance, Arhat main nuance in this very life in the era of the Gautama, Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of Navachapacham be with you all. The Mahasangha will now transfer their best to you. Raga ginnin mitetnva Dvesha ginnin mitetnva Moha ginnin mitetnva Nibbana parama sukhayin Sukita taravitnva Nibbana parama sukhayin Sukita taravitnva Nibbana parama sukhayin Sukita taravitnva Mamada siyalu loka Sielu Satnvayo Nibbana Parama Sukhayin Sukita Taravitnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayin Sukita Taravitnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayin Sukita Taravitnva Raga Kini Niveva Dvesha Ghini Niveva Moha Ghini Niveva Nivan Sepa Labeva Nivan Sepa Labeva Nivan Sepa Labeva Tundrange, Susiananta Mahoguni Bilin, Sea Locus is Satyoman, Nibbana Pamasukin, Sukhtaran.